Discord and music, possible announcer if I add it in post. Opening intro in 3, 2, 1. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Fiction File Podcast, where we explore the wide world of narrative entertainment, from movies to literature and everything in between. My name is Jason Boyd. I'm the editor of Fiction File, and I'm joined today by managing editor Corinne Asbell. Hey, Corinne.
Hello.
Hey, so Corinne's joining us remotely, and so is our next co-host, associate editor Dalton McKay. How are you doing, Dalton?
Doing great.
Awesome. Cool. So I think we got the whole crew. Today, we'll be poring over a single work of fiction. After we introduce this work of art, we'll discuss what makes it enjoyable, what makes it a work of art in the first place, what makes it universally relatable, and finally, we'll talk about what it could have done better. So now that we have our format, what piece of narrative entertainment are we talking about today, Kareem?
Well, up for discussion today is Final Fantasy VII. The role-playing game was first released January 31st, 1997. It was published and developed by Square and released by Sony Computer Entertainment for play on the original PlayStation console. The game was then re-released August 14, 2012 for Windows. And then just recently, a high-definition remake was developed by Square Enix and released with timed exclusivity for the PlayStation 4 on April 10th, 2020. I think that's actually a one-year exclusive deal for PlayStation.
An apathetic former soldier turned mercenary joins eco-terrorist group Avalanche in a mission to fight against the megacorporation Shinra Electric Power Company, who attempts to drain the planet's lifeblood as an energy source to further their profits.
Yep, sounds like nonfiction.
It really does.
Let's look over the critical opinion of this one just to kind of get a, historical overview, I suppose. IMDb, which little did I know before starting this podcast, apparently rates things other than movies, put this at 9. What's that?
Any acting.
Anything any acting.
Like that? Yeah.
Well, then they need to change the M to A. Anyway, I'll get in touch with them.
I don't know what acting was in the original.
Well, there's voice acting. Mm, no, there wasn't.
Not in the original, no.
Yeah, because
I think that at the point it has to deal with, like, it had a script and a director and...
Oh, okay.
I don't think their criteria is very strict.
So anything with a script, so it needs to be ISDB?
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know what? We'll get a conference call together with the IMDb folks, and we'll go over this.
Yes.
I think Jeff Bezos. I think Amazon owns IMDb, so we'll get Jeff Bezos on the line, and maybe he can contribute a little bit to Fiction File. IMDb website puts it at 9.5 out of 10, and the 2020 remake is also a 9.5 out of 10. On Metacritic, it's a 92 for the original and 88 for the remake. Okay. Google has the remake at 94%. There's no percentage for the original. So interesting there, especially that the remake is less on Metacritic. I'm just going to chalk that up to cynicism.
Probably.
right. Let's move on.
I just want to. I haven't played the remake, so man, I've heard that it kind of takes the story in a weird direction at the end something. So a lot of people hated it. A lot of people that were fans of the original hated it because of that.
Yeah, I did. I did read that it quote unquote rewrote history.
But anyway,
so we'll I have not played the remake either. So that's just as. Warning to y'all at home. Corinne, have you played the remake?
Yes, I'll loan it to you when I'm done with it.
Dope.
Okay, you know where I'm heading on this one. Good. All right, so let's talk about our first topic. What makes Final Fantasy VII enjoyable? Corinne? You want to start?
Alexa Prize is not available. Wait, hold on.
Hold on. Alexa wanted to join the, fuck it, I, go away.
You can only set the volume between 0 and 10.
3, 2, 1. Okay, so let's start with our first topic here. Corrine, if you want to kick this off, what makes Final Fantasy VII enjoyable?
Well, I really love RPGs, and I'm sure you guys might have figured that out a little bit by now. But I really love them. Most of them start out slow. Like, you spend 6 hours customizing your character because you got to get it just right. Is this shade of blue? Does that match your eyes? You know, do you have that many? You know, the little details. They got to be perfect. This is supposed to be the embodiment of you. But right after you get through customizing your character, then it's just like an exposition and plot dump. It's just really slow. You've got to set the narrative, set the pace, see what's going on. But what was best about Final Fantasy, particularly this one, is that it just jumps right in. It does not waste any time. I mean, you start the game and then, you know, right away you're an eco-terrorist, you're blowing stuff up. And then you're off fighting an evil global corporation to try and save the planet. The game itself really pulls no punches when it comes to action. And I think it has a level of maturity that was lacking in the other games at the time of its original release. And I gotta love the game so much just because of the, like I said, this is the action. I mean, you don't have any chances to second guess anything. You're just, boom, you're in there, you're running, you gotta get shit done.
Yeah, absolutely. It really, it uses, I wanna say it's called pre-existing conflict, but it's a narrative technique that Shakespeare used a lot. And you're starting a story in media res, so to speak. So in the middle of things.
Yeah.
That's the only Latin I know, but it's starting in the middle of things. But what it's doing is it's showing you the tail end of something that was already going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll move on to new stuff. But it informs you about who the character is, what they were doing, and then maybe it'll be referenced later as important.
Yeah.
And so it's a very smart way to do it, and it does it in a way that's like just makes it action-packed too. So yeah it's a great narrative technique that they used. So it just shows that, you know, this game knows what it's doing.
Yeah, I think they had to do that, and I think we'll probably talk about this more later, but you know, because this was the first game on PlayStation. This was the first time it jumped from Nintendo. And a lot of people were kind of worried about like, oh, well, you know, it's not going to be on Nintendo. You know, what's going to be different? Even though, you know, realistically, Nintendo had very little to do with it. It was Square. And I think they had to start out strong like that.
Yes, yeah. You're right. Yeah.
Speaking of the maturity of this title, like, RPGs at the time, let's see, one of my favorite games of all time, Final Fantasy Tactics, was in the same year. You also had stuff like Breath of Fire 3, another one of my favorite games of all time.
I love Breath of Fire.
Oh, yeah. Breath of Fire is one of my favorite.
So cute.
But contrast that, and then you also had like Mortal Kombat 4. But contrast that with stuff like other things that were coming out at the time. You had like Yoshi's Story, like Croc, Crash Bandicoot, Diddy Kong Racing, Star Fox. There was just a lot of like cutesy stuff going on then. And I think 1997 was sort of a landmark gaming year in general.
Yeah, and what's funny is that, like, I remember when Crash Bandicoot came out, and they were just acting like Crash Bandicoot was the best game of all time. And I was like, yeah, cool, all right. I mean, not that Final Fantasy VII was overlooked. Everyone knew it was great.
Yeah.
But, like, it just seemed like Crash Bandicoot was going to be Hall of Fame level.
Oh, that game is pretty good, though.
It's fun, but you know,
it's a lot harder than I remember it being, though.
It's yeah, it is hard. well, we'll do that one next. So, Dalton, what do you think makes Final Fantasy VII enjoyable?
I've always enjoyed this entry in the series for its world building and the lore aspect. I'm not a super fan of tech heavy Final Fantasy entries like 6, 7, 8, 13. But yeah, like the super tech heavy ones, I'm not a huge fan of those. Mm-hmm. 10 uses it a little bit, but it uses it as a plot device and it's and character motivation, so it's cool. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of in the background. But 7 manages to work the tech itself into the narrative as well. And they conclude that the kind of technology that they're using isn't a good thing. In fact, it kind of becomes the crux of the first act. 7's world building is the strongest aspect, as it manages to blend the pastoral, idyllic fantasy scape of the open world mm-hmm. with a technological nightmare, alien technology, and ancient magic in an interesting way. It has all these different sort of elements in it that you wouldn't think would be able to fit together, but then they mm-hmm. manage to somehow do that, and it's not boring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it shouldn't work. It really shouldn't work at all. Like, and it's crazy that it did. And I want to say no one's really tried to do as good of a job except other Final Fantasies.
Yeah, like imagine if this game came out like as a movie now, and it was like, oh well, it's like this guy with a big sword, and he's fighting what's he fighting? A power company. Yeah, he's fighting a power company. Yeah, and there's aliens and aliens. Yeah, an alien virus and magic rocks. It's like,
there's going to be lots of steam.
Yeah. I like it.
All right.
Cut. Yeah, that one would get put in the reject file real quick.
Yeah.
Cut print. But it's a blend. For me, what makes it enjoyable is just, I just like actually messing around in the game. I mean, I obviously from the Skyrim episode, we know that I like to just goof off half the time in my video games. But, you know, in most RPGs, and Final Fantasy kind of has done this a few times, sadly, and it's usually the reason I put down a Final Fantasy title, is that it's on rails, you know.
Yeah.
And you kind of feel like you can only go from one spot to the other. And you have that... Yeah. You have it early on in this game, but I feel like it loosens up later. But then what you really get, especially like mid game, late game, is you get a ton of mini games you can play, and there's Easter eggs, and there's just so much stuff that, like, I would be reading magazines. I had subscriptions to everything. I'd be reading magazines and going back to play the game and figure stuff out. And it just makes it so, it makes it so replayable.
Yeah.
And it makes it more than just whatever the, you know, main focus was, which to me, that was almost the first time you saw that kind of thing in a video game where it was almost like an open world feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Almost.
And I really actually like the character progression system.
Yeah.
And I like the little weapon mods, putting the little jewels and things.
Yeah,
the
and stuff.
Yeah, I thought that was, you know, and that I know Final Fantasy always likes to change it up every title, but I thought that was a pretty clean system. So it didn't get, like, too confusing. It was a nice balance. Also, I thought the battles were actually really well done, because sometimes you feel like you're running out of time all the time and you're panicking and you can't, like, play fast enough. Yeah, but there was kind of a nice – what's it called?
That's the ATB system at work there. And it's, yeah, it's actually used in a lot of their earlier titles. They use it in Chrono Trigger too. That little bar fills up and then it's your turn. The way that that works is that while your bars are filling up, the enemy's bars are filling up, and they're all filling up at different paces. So you could get into a situation where the boss or the enemies have like two or three turns before you think to act, just because like their bars don't stop filling up just because you're thinking of stuff. There's an option to turn that off, but it doesn't work as good as I think it should.
Yeah, but yet it doesn't like the most recent Final Fantasy. Mm-hmm. It was hard for me to play because
15.
The one where you're like in a car and with your 15. Bros.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was because everything was so in real time.
Yeah.
And it just felt so chaotic to me, when like an RPG to me is kind of almost a tactical thing. I like having a slower pace, thoughtful kind of strategy in the battle.
Yeah, you probably like JRPGs more than just regular RPGs. Because that's one of the things that I liked most about the remake, other than just visually it's beautiful, is that you did get, instead of the turn-based fighting system, you actually did get to fight. Mm. You know, they took the fighting mechanics, or very similar mechanics, to Final Fantasy 15, and that's what they used for the Final Fantasy 7 remake.
Yeah.
And it just felt more active.
Yeah, from what I understand, there's also, in the remake, there's also a feature where you can kind of pause for a second and choose your commands.
A tactical menu or something like that. I can't remember what it's called, but yeah.
See, that makes it less enjoyable. So, like, just, you know, talking about enjoyability itself, that's, to me, something that I really liked about Final Fantasy VII, the original. Mm-hmm. So that is something that's something that makes me not like the remake as much and not be as looking forward to playing it. So good stuff to know there. Let's talk about what makes Final Fantasy VII a work of art. And I'll go ahead and kick it off. I think, to me, it was the visual design. I mean, take a look at the way that one of these huge, like, smokestack, dungeony, but also a factory-looking vistas compare to Crash Bandicoot. Like, it's just, it's totally, I mean, one just blows the other out of the water. And I think it just is so combining of all these genres that we're talking about. Like, it has a cyberpunk, it's got some urban fantasy, and all of that can be communicated through the story and the characters, and it is. You have a guy with hands, you know, guns for hands. What's that?
Yeah, and the character designs themselves. Like,
right. I mean, you have the guy with guns for hands.
Yeah, gun for hand. You know exactly what his role in the party is going to be when you look at him.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of tell his personality just by looking at him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can tell what kind of world this is. You know, it's a little bit more. And I think all just the visuals describe these things better than any other aspect of narrative can do. And so there's that, but then also one of the things that to me really made it a work of art was the, and I don't really want to spoil anything, but,
spoiler alert,
there's a death in the game, you know, and I never really experienced death in a video game of this level where like you actually get to know a character and then they die,
you actually lose a party member.
Yeah, and I don't want to spoil, but like, you know, this is also a game where you can revive people and you're kind of like, well, this sucks.
Yeah.
But because you could revive them in a battle, you know, and under certain circumstances, but particularly the person who dies, it makes it especially tough.
The Phoenix Down doesn't work on them.
Well, that's true. Right. You could always use that.
You're tickling their nose with his Phoenix Down and be like, get up, get up.
Just so you know, I am completely spoil this later, so.
Yeah. Well, okay.
Stop listening now, y'all, if y'all don't know the plot of Final Fantasy VII.
Yes, please do stop, because that is a huge one. That's such a – that makes you go, damn, now I really, like, want to get this bitch, you know? Like, I want to get this little punk. So it makes you, like, hate the villain more than any other game I've ever played.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much to hate about this villain, though.
I know,
but not
I know,
his but... sweet, sweet style.
Oh God, he's sexy, isn't he? He's so likable in that way.
He's a bunch of pointy pixels. Not really.
Talk to me about the remake. Oh really? Okay, I'll need to look that up. But he's got such swooshy pixels, Karina. So swooshy of game design pixels. But what do you think makes it a work of art, Curry?
Well, it is, for me, it's the characters, you know, their stories. I mean, they kind of start out as pretty much walking, talking, well, kind of talking cliches, I guess. Cloud is your stereotypical male hero. He's cold. He's emotionless. He's more of a shadow of a person than an actual person. And as the story progresses, he's eventually able to realize there's more to being a hero than just blowing stuff up. Barrett, or Guns for Hands as you know him, is the angry black guy cliche, but he uses that to cover up the heart of gold and how he's torn between fighting to save the planet and caring for his daughter. And then Aerith, or Aerith, depending on which game you're playing, according to the wiki, though, it's Aerith with a TH. Is the innocent girl in need of saving cliche. And she winds up unintentionally, spoiler alert, it's unintentional because she's just praying for magic to stop Sephiroth, our swoony bad guy, and he stabs her. And she winds up unintentionally sacrificing herself in the Forgotten City. I mean, like, it's been a long time talking about these characters and what makes them interesting, but they all have these hidden depths that you get to explore as you play the game. Yeah. And you wind up really caring about them. It's like you said earlier when you're talking about Aerith, that it just shocked you that, you know, at the end of the first disc, like, boom, she's dead. You know, some of us are sitting there thinking like, man, she had good equipment. You can't go back and unequip her armor. But for the rest of us, you know, we're all like, oh man, that's sad. She died. Like, why did we put such emotion to her? Why was there so much put into this character and now she's dead? So, yeah.
That's exactly why.
I mean, it goes back to like what I was talking about with the Shakespearean use of pre-existing conflict. The drama is just so heightened in this. They really like do not pull punches on what makes good drama. And that includes investing in a character and then them dying untimely before their arc is ended.
Yeah. Actually, the director, and I forgot his name, I'm sorry. I was going to look up how to pronounce it because I can't, but I forgot it.
Tetsuya Nomura.
Mm-hmm. They actually were talking about, like, with the fan outrage, the outpouring of grief for Aerith, they demanded she was done wrong. They wanted her back. And he's like, well, that's how you know we did a good job with her.
Exactly.
And they did that with all the characters.
You know, unfortunately, but that's just kind of the truth. It's like, you know, the only thing that, I mean, a character riding off into the sunset is nice, but only certain characters get to do that. Mm-hmm. A really good death is like, you know, it's a Viking kind of thing, but still, like, it's the best thing you can do for a character is give them a good death, because we're going to assume they die off camera anyway. So it's like, they probably just die in a hospital bed. But, you know, this way it's like they go out in a dramatic fashion and they'll always be remembered.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
But,
that is one of those... one of those places in video game history that anyone who's ever gone through it will never forget it.
Yeah. Dalton, what do you think makes Final Fantasy VII a work of art?
Well, this is probably the most complicated entry in the Final Fantasy series. The narrative, for sure. The game systems can be very complicated. They're easy on the surface, but they have a lot of depth to them beyond. Like when you finally, you know, realize that materials that are linked together can play off of each other. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that increases the complexity of the battle system. But the narrative is incredibly complex. It weaves in and out of unreliable narrators, which means that, like, even at the beginning of the game, we start in Medias Res, as you said, but we don't understand exactly how in the middle of things this game starts until we get all the way through it. Because, and how much false information that we are fed through the entire game until we get to the end, to where we can finally have a revelation. So the unreliable narrator is strong, and there's more than one. So, but from that, there are some plot holes, but I don't think that there are any big enough to fit your hand through. So, and there's a lot of sharp plot twists, and as we've already discussed, emotional gut checks, and more than one, heightened drama, as you said. This game is a roller coaster of emotions, and it's delivered in like a colorful, spiky package.
Spiky in particular. Yes. Very good points there. And yeah, the unreliable narrator is the fact that you're playing, you know, that you're almost complicit in it, you know, feeling because you have that interactivity.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's more shocking than a, you know, movie like Fight Club or something.
Yeah, it's like, oh, what a plot twist. It's like, no, but like you live it when you,
yeah.
That's why I continually say that for highly complex narratives and character development, you can't beat video games, especially because it has that additional layer of interactivity.
Good point. Great point. So what makes Final Fantasy VII universally relatable? Dalton, do you want to keep on?
Yeah, I'll keep it. This game has so many themes that anyone playing it is bound to find one that resonates with them. There's the central obvious thread of humanity against the environment. So you've got man versus nature immediately, where this terrorist organization, well, they're called terrorists, but you know, and they are, I mean, it's hard to talk about this game without going,
yeah, it's but, like, you know, pre 9/11, post 9/11 kind of thing. Yeah.
But it's like these eco-terrorists are trying to save the planet from the big bad corporation. So there's also poor versus the wealthy conflict going on. You've also got every character has a different methodology in relating to them. You have different character arcs that are dealing with guilt, revenge, hatred, broken dreams, in the case of Cid, which is pretty sad too. And then the nature of identity, like who am I and what decides who I am? Is it me or is it my past? Is it my future? These are all questions that everyone has struggled with, and this game just sort of lays them out there on a silver platter.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, and I mean, it's goes along with its complex story. It's incredibly diverse mixture of genres. That it's almost like, well, it's going to be relatable. So I kind of struggled with this part a little bit just because it's like, well, I mean, first of all, when you play a video game, the immersive aspect for me personally always makes it relatable because I get into it and I feel like I'm the person.
Correct.
And I felt like Cloud was pretty empty and I could really like just, you know, put myself in him.
yeah. And then you find out that that's really by design. that he's so
for so many
reasons.
But then I found this one quote that I thought was interesting. So Gene Park of the Washington Post said that it's a cyberpunk story about personal delusions, mental illness, climate change, and class warfare. It was Blade Runner for millennials. And I thought that was pretty funny, being a millennial myself, you know, and that's one of the things that make it, you know, relatable. And cyberpunk always seems to be relatable for young people. I don't know why, like, cyberpunk as a genre just, it appeals to young people. It appealed to me as a young person. But
you
there
were a young
is
person?
Once.
I thought you were born old.
1908.
I think that cyberpunk relates to us as millennials a lot because of the times that we grew up in. You know, there's emerging, rapidly advancing technology,
right.
And then you have division in classes growing wider throughout our lifetime. You have terrorism. You have there are so many things that cyberpunk feeds off of that speak to us as millennials personally.
It's cyberpunk. A big thing about cyberpunk too is that feeling of the man. You know,
yeah.
It's always like the man,
always,
you know,
a big corporation to fight or something.
Well, and it's because things have gotten, it's usually because of technology where it's like, well, technology's gotten to such a point that there's this dualism between democratization of information, but then power and resources are still finite.
Yeah.
So you have an informed populace without any power to do anything about it.
Exactly, yeah.
And you know, that's going to cause problems. And it's something that, like, we're seeing in real life, and it's just relatable. But Corinne, what do you think makes this game universally relatable?
Well, I mean, I'm kind of cribbing off Dalton's notes a little bit here. What does relate most with me is the story that it's telling. It's, you know, capitalism gone wrong and how it's hurting the environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you were talking about, it's humanity against the environment. It really just showcases that struggle of the human progress versus protecting nature. And it's kind of the ultimate shoulda, woulda, coulda, but didn't. You know, we should have done this. We would have done this if we'd known it was going to hurt. We could have done this, but we wanted to make profit, so we didn't. And then, you know, Avalanche comes in and they're the eco-terrorist group and, you know, they come along and they start helping nature fight back. And you've got Barrett, you know, he's describing the planet as crying out in pain. And he's like, he can feel this, like, on a level. He can feel the planet's pain. And then you've got him yelling at Shinra that they're sucking the planet dry of, I can never remember how to say this, Mako?
I think it's Mako.
I'm not sure, but yeah, we'll go with Mako. That sounds, you know, more realistic. And, you know, what are they going to do when all the Mako is gone? And it's kind of like, you know, what are we going to do when all the oil is gone?
Uh-huh.
You know, we haven't switched on to a different form of power. What are we going to do? And then, you know, what I like about the remake is that you would kind of expect that maybe they would just keep the message the same, or maybe even try to lean away from it to try to, you know, sell more copies today, what with, you know, the huge divide between, you know, the younger generation that is about, you know, protecting the environment, and the older generation that is about making money. They all buy video games for the most part. But the remake even leans in more into the warnings from the original. And it's like the writers really want us to have a discussion about just what we're doing to the planet. And it's almost like this is the future. Like, if we don't stop, then this is what's going to happen. We're going to be having someone like Avalanche coming in and trying to force us to stop.
Yeah.
I'm putting my soapbox aside now. Sorry.
Sign me up for the superpowers, though. You know, if they can start grafting alien bits onto me and letting me like jump super high and twirl a gigantic sword over my head and I'll have like ripped abs forever. Sign me up.
So you want to be a member? You want to be a member of Soldier?
I'll go to Soldier. Whatever.
You're gonna have to like spike your hair though. Is there enough hair gel for your hair?
There will be. I imagine that. I imagine
is that part magic power?
Yeah,
always use oil.
Part magic power and part industrial strength glue that I'm sure that they will have in the future that like just washes out real easy.
Space glue.
Okay, I just want to make sure you've got a lot of hair, so we got to make sure it looks right the part.
Well, it'll work. The more to work with, but it's a good point because too, like we have this situation where it's late '90s. It's '97, right? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of right before we got super, super serious about climate change. And by we, I mean half of the population. The other half still needing convincing.
Yeah, I still remember all the that's when all the ads started in school, you know, reduce, reuse, recycle, all that big campaign.
Yeah. Well, and we had like an organization like Greenpeace. Mm-hmm. And Greenpeace was kind of, I think it was Greenpeace, but, there were basically organizations that would, for instance, go out, and they still do this today. They'll go out where people are hunting whales in international waters, mm-hmm. and they will basically attack the boats like pirates. To try to like deter them from hunting the whales, and it's like they were kind of during the 97 like type of late 90s, it was kind of a joke because it was like, it's just a bunch of hippies, like riding around in boats yelling at people, it's fine.
Yeah, I remember that's kind of my parents' mentality about it was, as much as they cared about that stuff, maybe they saw it on the news and were like, a bunch of hippies in boats.
Yeah. And, but then, this game is like, oh no, but what if, things got really worse and then blah, 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 blah. And we're seeing that now. Yeah. Like it's prophetic and it's really interesting how it did that. And it was kind of ahead of its time in talking about the subject itself. Definite kudos. Okay, so what could have Final Fantasy VII have done better? Kareen, do you want to talk about this first?
Yeah, for me, what it could have done better is... I don't know. I don't want to like get on my soapbox again, especially after I just got off of it.
Soapbox.
Okay, let me get it back out. My biggest issue with the game is Aerith's death. She seemed to have like she was going to have a much bigger role in the game. She was going to be a much more important character, only to die at the end of the first disc. And she was a really good example of the disposable woman trope. I've also heard it called fridging, but I don't think that really.
There's a more morbid version of that name, but yeah.
Yeah, but I don't really think the whole fridging thing really fits. But she was just there. Her entire purpose is to fuel Cloud's man pain, mm-hmm. and give him the inner strength and motivation so he could fight Sephiroth and save the planet. I mean, that was her purpose. She died so Cloud could all of a sudden decide that, we have to do something and we have to fight Sephiroth. I mean, she was a really sweet character. And we talked about how she deserved better, how she was a well-loved character. I mean, they did a petition to try to get this change. And this was back in the 90s, and they did a petition. It's not like today where... you stub your toe and then you write a petition against, the firm.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, people, really felt her death and she was wasted. And I think, honestly, I would have been more okay with it if, you know, it literally just wasn't the fuel cloud. It's for his mangst. You know, it's like all of a sudden, you know, she said Cloud has a reason to fight. That's not what women are there for.
Hmm. Yeah, I get that, but I do think you saying like that she had a bigger role, it seemed like. Mm-hmm. And that's the perfect time to kill somebody.
Like, I know
narratively. Not in real life.
Yeah.
I know narratively it made sense. But also in the fact that, you know, we had this sweet young innocent girl. We could have killed off a dude. Barrett could have died. No.
Barrett would have been a good choice to kill somebody, like if not Error.
Wait, because- you mean Barrett would have been a good choice to die? Or for Barrett to kill somebody? It's not clear the way you said it.
But no, it would have been, he would have been, if you're going to kill somebody, kill off a character, Barrett would have been a good choice too.
Yeah. And
because he's likable. He's been there from the beginning, you know.
He's been more impactful because, you know, he was the big tough guy, but he had a daughter and then were more emotional. But it's just, I know it makes sense. But I feel like they could have maybe done it a little bit better and not make Cloud's motivation literally just because she died. Maybe she could have encouraged him beforehand and he started to get some motivation and then her death cemented it. That might have been a little bit less, you know, disposable.
Yeah. But anyway. Yeah. No, I get your point. I mean, she's definitely set up to be the genteel woman. You know, yeah. You have... she kind of fits that feminine role so mm-hmm. much too, with the dresses and all that kind of stuff. It makes it
death.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's the group's mom basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So it does lend itself to being more of a disposal woman trope, unfortunately, just because she's already being put in what we would automatically assumed to be a lesser standard because she's a caretaker instead of the action oriented doing things person.
But so, yeah. You gotta give her credit. She did try to do some action when it really counted. Because that's the reason why she was in the Forgotten City to begin with, is because Sephiroth was gonna use Meteor.
Yeah.
I think it was the magic he was gonna use. Meteor. And she was going to pray so she could use Holy, which was the only counter.
Yeah.
So that's the reason why she went down there, because she was the one that could do it.
Yeah, she was the only one that could do it. Mm-hmm. In that regard, her role was filled, and when she was killed, it sort of became a Jedi thing, because she became the most powerful force on Earth the moment she was killed. Like, the moment she entered the life stream, like, she was able to, you know, pray for Holy. She was able to assist. Like, Holy didn't defeat Meteor by itself. At the end of the game, when Meteor's about to crash into the planet, and we see Marlene, and we see Holy finally fire from the bowels of the Earth, Holy didn't do it by itself, because it was too late. Eris actually brings all of the souls from the life stream out in order to help save the planet and everyone still living. And you know it's Eris because they show her right as everything happens. So strike me down and I will become more powerful than you could ever imagine.
I mean, that's a good point. You're not going to make me like her death anymore by comparing it to Star Wars.
No.
I'm not that weak. I'm not that
that's
weak.
Your trick.
That was my trick. I was just trying to take the sting out of it just a little bit, because I feel you getting a little emotional over there.
And you can hear Jason crying.
But yes. Dalton, what do you think it could have done better?
Well, for as much as I laud the complexity of this narrative, for as much as I love all the elements coming together, I think that the overall story of Final Fantasy VII is just far too convoluted. like, I think that there's a difference between complexity and being convoluted. And Final Fantasy VII tips toward convoluted real heavily. There are too many plot threads, too many extra characters. Cate Sith. If Cate Sith wasn't a character in this game, Cate Sith's role is to be an undercover operative and to be crushed by the Meteor Temple, because whenever someone solves all the puzzles, it's going to shrink down to materia size. Those are his only two roles. Other than that, you got nothing. Cid, as much as I like Cid, his only reasons for being there was, number one, to put a Dragoon in the game, number two, to bring about the airship, and to basically fly everybody. Like, he didn't really have an overall narrative purpose for being there. Yuffie's completely superfluous. We get her at a point where we're already sort of invested in all the other characters, and she's just there for us to hate, basically. Like, she also serves no narrative purpose. There's no big reason for her to be there other than to be a ninja. I could go on. I could go on for most of the cast of this game, and all of them having their own arcs, their own plot threads that tie tangentially into the main narrative, is too much. If I was going to rewrite the story of Final Fantasy VII, that's where I would have started, is by culling some of the extra characters and plot threads to make it a little more unified. Mm-hmm. I mean, plot twists are fine and enjoyable, but having so many, the number of which skyrocket the closer you get to the end of the game, is, in my opinion, detrimental to the overall experience. It's like you finally start to understand the thing. You finally start to get a sense of what's going on. And then when you get near the end of the game, like about the last, I'll say, 15 hours. The last 15 hours of the game, it's just rapid fire. Boom, boom, boom. These things that you thought, those aren't the things that you thought. And it, like, toward the end, you're just like, oh my God, can we just, yeah. I don't want this anymore. Can we, like, I just want something to hold on to. It's like, but yeah, that's my two cents.
Yeah, and I mean, that kind of feeds into what I was going to say, too, is that for me, the game was just so long.
Oh, yeah. So,
especially for a guy who goofs off all the time. Like, you know, if I'm goofing off and I'm like, because we're probably near the end. I kept thinking I was near the end. Like, and I still, it just feels like you're reaching the end so many times.
Yes.
And then it keeps going. So it's like, you know, I would pause and be like, you know, I'm going to go play some mini games before this game ends.
What
did I know? You know,
it's the extended cut of Lord of the Rings.
I mean, it is three discs. You know, it wasn't exactly going to be a small game.
Right. Sure. Well, yeah, I knew on disc two it wouldn't be over, but but it's so long, and I think it's like 70 plus hours. I've seen up to 100 hours if you do like every mini game, and that's not including just general goofing off like I did. But then the main story for Skyrim is 36 hours and 30 minutes. The main story for Final Fantasy is about 40 hours. So the main story itself is longer than Skyrim. So just for an older game too to be that long, to me, it was a little too long. I just felt like I could not sustain interest, and I kind of just wanted to get to the end at a certain point.
I wonder how much of the length was to justify to themselves and to Nintendo why they had to move to PlayStation. Because the reason why they went with Sony is because they told Nintendo, this game's too big for a cartridge. You're going to have to start doing cartridges. And Nintendo was like, we're never going to stop doing cartridges. Then they put out the N64, and then they went to cartridges.
Yep.
But, I mean, I wonder how much it is like, well, we've got to prove to them that we were right all along. Maybe. So three discs of nothing.
Maybe, but then it also just makes sense that in general, like Dalton saying, they have all these characters. They could have just fallen in love with all these characters and thought, well, we got to have that. We got to have Dragoon. We got to have a ship that they can fly around and stuff like that.
Ninja's been in every game since. We need a ninja in there.
No, and you add a character and you have to add to the plot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or else it's also stupid, you know?
And then also they've got, like, for the time, these beautiful 3D graphics, you know, that they hadn't, you know, had really done before, you know, because the previous Final Fantasy game were just the little 2D sprites. So, you know, maybe that was a combination of they designed these characters, they fell in love with them. So they're like, well, we've got to put every single character we've ever thought of ever in this game.
Yeah. Like, you know, that, you know, John worked 40 years on that one character. I get your point for sure. Because you can fall in love with these creations when you're a creator. And so I understand that. But still, you know, it was worth it because I liked the game. So it being long is kind of, you know, a small fault that I'm willing to overlook for sure. So, yeah.
Yeah, but there was another game in 1999. North America was 2000, I think. The Legend of Dragoon. So this is probably my favorite game of all time. It was four discs long. And this was after, you know, upgraded hardware for discs and stuff, you know, but it was four discs long. And the way that they kept this kept it fresh for so long was that every disc was a self-contained chapter. Every disc was a different setting. So you have, like, the first disc is mainly in one area. It's kind of like a I can't really describe it. It has multiple topographies. I can't really describe the first disc because it had like a prairie, a grasslands, had some mountain stuff going on anyway. But then you go into the second disc and it's a completely different place. It's like, you know, it's a coastal city. And then, you know, you have disc three and you're into like a very forested mountain area and then, you know, disc four, like all hell breaks loose and suddenly you're thrust into the moon. Spoilers. But it's, you can make a long game feel less long. And I think Final Fantasy VII definitely has a problem in that regard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, yeah, I agree, but, you know, it's a classic. What kind of final thoughts do we have about this game? I'll go ahead and just say, you know, to me, I just really think it's brilliant. It was kind of the first game that I played all the way through myself, and like was my favorite game, and I could talk about it, and I got the like guide for it, and you know, it was just such a touchstone because I was born in 86, so I guess I was 11 when this came out. And I almost can't really define everything about it because it's so unique. It is such a blend of things that it just felt like its own genre. It co-opted so much from other genres that it made something new. Mm-hmm. And I really think that's a good template for anyone trying to divert from a genre. Like, so many people go, well, we want to do that, but we kind of want to do our take on a zombie movie. You know, it's like, okay, well, but you got to kind of combine other things and really make it unique. And a lot of unique aspects of fine literature and fine art is through combining old things. Mm-hmm. So new synthesis out of existing material. Just because there's the saying, there's nothing new under the sun. There's not really, other than historical events that will happen in the future, there's nothing new that we can grasp upon in the human experience so far. Mm-hmm. So you can't just write a movie where it's like, yeah, and then they get double divorced. You know, it's like, well, there's only a divorce, you know? And so it's like you have to try to come up with these new things, but you can only do that by referring to existing things. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, if you're going to come up with double divorce, well, then now it's sci-fi, right? So now you have to use like sci-fi type tropes. But then you have to divert from that maybe by combining a romantic drama like Marriage Story with, you know, Adam Driver. And so then you're combining things and you're using elements that people will get, but then it becomes something new.
Jason, and, like, I'm sorry to interrupt, but like you're in my head right now. Those are the exact things I was thinking of combining.
Like, yeah.
Double divorce, sci-fi, and then, like, you know, have like a I saw a clip from Marriage Story. I haven't seen the entire movie yet, but I saw a clip from Marriage Story the other day. I was like, you know what, that would work. And
double divorce. I'm
gonna say you're also in my head, Jason, because you mentioned Adam Driver. So
we know that Adam Driver's always in your head. So
well, he can have a lightsaber and be shirtless because it's sci-fi. It'll be.
Okay,
that's the lightsaber in my head. Okay, but it's just this game is such a unique thing, but at the same time, such an example for people trying to create something unique, because mm-hmm. it shows that you don't have to come up with something completely new. Because mm-hmm. it's not like you can go into a cave and meditate for 20 years and come out with a new genre. Instead, it creates its own genre by combining and recreating and reimagining other genres. Anyway, but I'll get off my soapbox. Kareem, what are your final thoughts about this game?
Well, that soapbox really getting a lot of use this time.
I know. I feel tall.
My final thoughts about this game had to be, it's like, it's really nostalgia for me. I mean, it's kind of like a trip down memory lane. It's one of the first games I remember buying for PlayStation, my brother's PlayStation. I didn't have one. It was his. I mean, but it was Final Fantasy VII. I wasn't really sure that it was going to be good, but my friends had wanted to play it. So, you know, you had to play. So, you know, y'all have something to talk about at school.
Yeah.
I mean, it, like we mentioned earlier, this is the first time it wasn't going to be on Nintendo. I didn't know how big of a difference that was going to make, which turned out it made a huge difference and in a pretty good way. I mean, because of the new format or the new storage, I should say, the game looked amazing for 1997. It's not my favorite Final Fantasy of all time. That's actually probably Final Fantasy 15. Like, I legitimately cried.
It's really
I
had good.
No game. I cried. It was a beautiful game.
I just need to play it more. Yeah, I gave up on it.
But, and then followed probably by 8, which, you know, they're doing a remake of that too. So I'm kind of excited. Mm-hmm. But anyways, we're talking about Final Fantasy 7. But it's a good game. I mean, I bought the remake when it came out because I did have fond memories of the game, even though there were issues with it. You know, as we discussed, like how I felt about Aerith's death and some other things, it's just too good of a game, I think. Even though, like we all talk, it's convoluted, it can be confusing, it's very long, it's very much longer in the remake, but I think it's worth it.
Very good. Dawn, what are your final thoughts on this one?
Well, First of all, I want to say that 15 was a very good game, and it got a lot of hate for no reason. And I think that it springs from the fact that people just like teenage boys don't like to cry. So there you go.
I don't know why they would hate on it. I mean, it got a lot more hate than it seemed like. What was it? Lightning got.
Oh yeah, Lightning is just. I'm not going to go into it. I have thoughts on 13, but 7 is not my favorite of the series. And full disclosure, to this day, I've never gotten all the way through the game. I watched a lot of recaps and a lot of just story explanations in preparation for this, because I could never get through the whole thing. Like Jason said, it's too long, too complex, too convoluted, and
it gets tough. It gets so tough sometimes. You're like, it's not worth it.
It made my eyes bleed. Like, just. So yeah, 7 is not my favorite. I understand what it has to offer to the anthology as a whole, and it is one of the greatest entries in the series, and it's the entry that brought a lot of people from the West into the fold, which was needed.
Yes.
Like 1 through 6, some of them didn't even come here to North America. The people that did play them were sort of in the minority. But I mean, that alone is worthy of accolade, as the influx of fans was needed to keep the series continuing as long as it has. And it's become one of the most beloved RPGs of all time. It's made a huge mark on popular culture, especially among fans of the Final Fantasy. That can't be understated. I mean, Cloud and Sephiroth, have been depicted in every way possible, from bitter rivals to lovers to statues to what have you. But I mean, for me, the greatest Final Fantasy game is a tie between Final Fantasy Tactics and Final Fantasy X. But 7's importance to the anthology cannot be understated. And I understand why it's so great after doing my research.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, at times it's almost like you have to look at things in a time capsule. You're like, you know, is this the kind of thing where it's going to be remembered? Maybe it's not the best. Maybe they perfected it later, but it's something where it's like, it really was a catalyst. It was a turning point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Thank you, guys. Wonderful thoughts as always. Before we move on, where can I, the listener, follow you guys on the social medias? Kareem.
You can find me on Facebook or Instagram at Nonlinear Girl. And my Twitter is Nonlinear Girl with a 0 instead of the O.
Very good. And Dalton, sir, where can people follow you and fanboy you?
I'm most active on Instagram at sword_gaijin. And then you can find me on Facebook at The Sword Gaijin Cosplay.
Excellent. And of course, you can find Fiction File on Facebook. Very poppin' atmosphere over there. You can find Twitter, Fiction File, MAG. And you can find me as The Fiction File on Twitter. You can also follow my Instagram at Sage Hazard, if you like, with 2 Z's. So, now that we got that wrapped up and we have tons of adoring fans heading our way, we should get to our social medias right away. But, Kareem, where can I find this game?
Well, if you're looking for the original copy, you can check your local GameStop and Prey or other online retailer for copy, but you can buy a digital copy through the PlayStation Store or through Steam for your computer, and then the remake is going to be available pretty much wherever video games are sold, since it just came out about 2 weeks before we recorded this. It should be available everywhere. Although you could just head over to fictionfile.com and click on our Amazon banner and order a copy that way. It'll just give us a little help. It doesn't cost you anything extra. And it just allows us to keep bringing you the content that you enjoy.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
I think you can get Final Fantasy VII on the Switch as well, right? Or has that not come out yet?
No. It's timed exclusive for PlayStation for 1 year. Right. It is only available on PS4.
I meant the original.
The original? I don't know.
It looks like you can.
Yeah, digital.
But hey, also go through fictionfile.com because we want that sweet, sweet taste. We want that candy. We want that sugar baby. We promise not to become a giant mega corporation that destroys the earth. We promise.
And if not for
entertainment.
And if they do, you can believe that I'm going to be the one with the spiky hair and the big sword, guys.
Yeah, hey, there we go. Yeah, I don't want Dalton coming after me with a big sword. So, good stuff. All right, well, thank you, Dalton. Thank you, Kareen. So, I think that's it for this installment of the Fiction File Podcast. I want to thank all you listening and invite you to fictionfile.com for more scintillating analysis like you heard today. And don't forget to rate us if you liked today's episode and subscribe to make sure you don't miss the next episode. And finally, I want to thank you for spending a little time with us today, a little story time. And for Dalton McKay and Kareen Asbell, this is Jason Boyd and the Fiction File family wishing you a happily ever after.